Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
This is a Lip Media podcast.
Buckle up, sodomites, and welcome to the Sinister Sissies podcast, your guide to true crime, horror, and everything man on man and macabre. I'm Jared, your master of depravity, and I'm here with my co-host, as always, my little slave Sam, who's riddled with diseases, but none of them corona.
Well, you know, TBC, he doesn't let me out, so I'm not exactly sure what I have, but he tells me it's not.
If you see Sam in public, cough on him.
I think I might have Stockholm Syndrome.
And we have a special guest today. We have Josh, a.k.a. Bathsheba, here today to talk about a particular true crime topic that he is excited about. Welcome.
Thank you very much for having me. Thank you for having me at this very strange time.
Yeah, we're not quite at the meter distance. Is it 6 meters? What are we meant to be?
I thought it was 4 meters.
I think it's 4 meters.
Anyway, we're way too close. We're riddled in each other's spit.
Likely we already have things that are way more dangerous than COVID anyway. So if anything, we're doing society a favor by being in a room together.
It is. We're containing our filth.
We're creating a super bug that only us will be affected by.
Exactly.
It's quite funny that we're doing a podcast about a party monster when we're not allowed to actually party.
No.
Yeah.
Although we are drinking now. This is a party.
Exactly.
You know, 14-year-old me would have been happy with this level.
This is a new version.
I have two friends and some booze.
What more could a girl want?
So what crime are we talking about today? Who are we talking about?
Today we're talking about Michael Arlig.
New York's downtown nightlife. Until his world spiraled out of control, ending in a brutal murder.
I said, we are either going to be caught with this dead body in our apartment, or we have to get rid of it somehow.
The drug abuse definitely contributed to Michael's decline, but a lot of people do drugs. They don't go around killing people and chopping them up, throwing them into rivers.
Ultimately, Michael is a very, very charming person. He's just got this very evil liquid center to him.
Michael Arlig was born in 1966, and he was the younger of two sons. He was a straight-A student in the top 8% of his class, would you believe? So, by all accounts, Michael Arlig was very intelligent and very charismatic, even from a young age. So, Michael Arlig was pretty relentlessly bullied, so he decided to move to New York City in 1984, where he enrolled...
Just before you go into that,
yeah.
Is there any truth to the idea that when he was younger, because he was bullied, he started, like, a lolly sales operation at school? Because that's in the film, and I'm assuming that's the kind of anecdote that's probably real.
I haven't seen that in my research, but that's a very cute anecdote from the film.
Yeah, as in, like, this idea that he was so intelligent he couldn't make friends, but instead he used to, like, bulk buy a whole bunch of lollies and then, like, upsell them to kids at school.
Well, that's a precursor to drug dealing, right?
Yeah.
And I'm also getting ideas for toilet paper right now, so lessons
I have no toilet paper. It sucks. So anyway, what happened when Michael Arlig got to New York?
So, well, he enrolled at Fordham University, and he enrolled in fashion and architecture. Now, do either of you know what New York was like in 1984?
Riddled with AIDS?
Pretty much. Yeah. But also, it was probably like what Detroit is like today, okay. AKA shit.
Yes, yeah. Well, the crime rate was humongous. There's that movie, A Most Violent Year.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's about the crime rate in New York, potentially even in 1984.
Yeah.
Out of control.
So in 1984, it was a bit of a post-punk sort of wasteland, a dystopia, if you will. So this is post-CBGB when, you know, bands like the Ramones or Blondie were heading down to the Bowery and having quite a good time. So all the fun seemed to be in the underground, which I quite enjoy in a way. But above...
I'd say as well, heroin's peaking at this point, yeah?
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. I think all drugs were pretty much peaking at this point. So that was a very interesting kind of way to look at New York. Now when you think of New York, it's such this glossy sort of wonderland and most of Manhattan. So it was totally different to that. If you look at some photos, it's, yeah, it's pretty much like Kosovo or like Detroit today. So it was not a fun time. So also Times Square was completely different. It was so raunchy. Like,
oh, yeah, little porn stores and stuff.
Absolutely, a lot of peep shows.
Yeah.
Sex workers on every corner. So completely different. It wasn't Disney-fied at this point.
Maybe we're going to like re-enter that grunge era now that we're in kind of a semi-apocalyptic
I would love it. I would thrive in
that. I am here for it. Like, why don't we start a band?
I'll see you on the street corner.
Yeah.
see you there.
Anyway, so Michael Alling turned up to New York City and worked as a busboy at a club called Danceteria, which a little-known pop star at the time called Madonna got her big break. And she was doing some pretty primitive shows for Madonna standards today. There was no cone bra or gyrating on any 20-year-old man.
Yeah.
But it was, that's what it was. And that was a very interesting time. Also, artists like Basquiat and Keith Haring were at their sort of creative pinnacle as well. So a very different scene from New York City at the time.
Question from me.
Yes.
How is he affording to live in New York? It's like, was New York cheaper back then?
Yes.
Oh,
see, that's
okay.
The thing.
Okay.
A lot of artists were saying at the time, rent was not an issue for them. So they could channel their funds into their art. Also, this was a post Studio 54 time as well.
Yeah.
So Studio 54, if everyone knows what that is.
I've seen that movie with Mark Wahlberg.
Yes. No, that's with Ryan Phillippe. You're thinking of Boogie Nights.
Yeah. 54 has Neve Campbell, Ryan Phillippe.
Selma Hayek. And for some reason, Mike Myers.
Is there like a sexy bit in that? Why am I viewing that as like a teenage wanky?
Yeah, I can see where you've crossed your wires with Boogie Nights.
They're
pretty similar. I think perhaps the same year they came out.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah.
Sexy times.
So around this time also, Andy Warhol created the phenomena of the celebutante.
Okay.
So that's famous for being famous. In essence, maybe that's the prelude to the Kardashians and people like that who have no talent whatsoever, but they're famous for their personalities. So Andy Warhol created the celebutante, and artists like Little Edie emerged, which people may know from Grey Gardens. So, again, I think that was the very early stages of people being interested in personalities as opposed to these people who have really no talent as such. And it's a very interesting side note that Studio 54 has this long-lasting legacy and they were only open for 11 months.
Really?
Yes. Michael Alley got a job as a busboy at Danceteria, which is a very cool club at the time. And Michael asked to participate in a go-go boy competition where apparently he was just terrible. Absolutely terrible.
Oh.
Apparently all these people came out and they had jock straps and they were like twirling from the ceiling, etc., pulling things out of mysterious places.
Sounds like me versus you if we were to...
Can we... His fabulous legs. We've seen it.
Apparently you saw more than my legs.
Oh yeah, we saw some balls as well.
Yeah.
Can we describe Michael Alec physically at this point?
Twinkie.
Okay.
Michael Alec was very twinkie. I guess the modern definition of a twink, which is quite lean. I would say he was quite cute.
Mm.
He was quite cute. If you're able to say that about a killer.
Yeah.
Well, I say it all the time about Jeffrey Dahmer. So
Jeffrey Dahmer? Yeah, young Jeffrey Dahmer.
Young Jeffrey Dahmer, not the one who was clobbered by a weight at the gym in jail and died.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
It's never what you want, you know.
So anyway, he competed in this go-go competition and he failed miserably, obviously, because he came out in pretty much a shimmy and that was it. He used that as an opportunity to hobnob with some promoters and he pretty much got up in their face and he thought of an idea for a night, which was the filthy mouth contest.
Ooh.
So pretty much people would come up on stage and just sling insults at the audience and the best insult won a jug of beer or whatever. So I actually kind of like that
idea. I like that as well.
Yeah. I guess this is pre-cancel culture, so you could say whatever you wanted.
Do you think that in the era of Michael Alec, when he started hosting these parties and becoming more involved in the scene, would you mm-hmm. say that maybe he'd be credited by some people as kind of revitalizing the queer dance scene, like post-AIDS?
Well, I think at this time he was a little bit of a pioneer at that time. I don't think there was much of a queer scene. I guess this is post, you know, peer culture, you know, that's that stereotype of queers going down to the pier and everything's quite in private, like yeah. jerking off each other, etc., on the dingy piers.
It's so like, it's like everything in cruising that I find like yeah. really titillating, where like they're just meeting in cruise spots and that's, and cruise spots and spas and not spas, yeah. and saunas.
Exactly,
and
yeah.
not, well, I feel, is,
there was a leather scene in New York in pre-AIDS, that's all I know.
My view is that like the view of the pink dollar and the view of being able to like commercially orientate yourself towards a gay demographic was more of a 90s thing.
Yeah, and definitely a today thing.
Oh, definitely. Everyone was so, now.
It's interesting yeah. you asked me that because around that time, Andy Warhol died in 1987. And that's when the...
Valerie Solanas Scum Manifesto, read it. It's interesting.
Absolutely. Shell, thank you for the recommendation,
yeah.
Jared. And so around that time, the Club Kid was born.
Here they are, the Club Kids. I'm telling you, this is the latest. You got to know about this. Keep your eye on these people. These young men and women, well, this, who are these people?
I heard an interesting quote when I was doing research for this, and it is, innovation is taking bits and pieces of what has come before and working them together in new ways. So in the culmination of Andy Warhol's death and the idea of the celebutante, etc., the Club Kid was born. And yeah, so I guess that's the answer to your question. Yeah.
The Club Kid aesthetic still lives. So, you know, I guess, you know, Michael's legacy, even though he's not dead, but you know, his legacy yeah. pre-murder is still emanating through our dance scenes.
I think particularly today, when you look at drag race contestants like Aquaria or Milk, who definitely appropriate things in a really wonderful way, I think. And even my own stuff, definitely have, reverberations from the Club Kid culture. Michael Alec started collecting a little clique of celebutants, shall we say, to support his club career. So people like James St. James and Lady Bunny, who are still popular and kicking around today. And by all accounts, Michael Alec was very charismatic and very fun, but by all other accounts, he was very annoying and very obnoxious. So I'm not surprised.
I've never met a drag queen like that. Never.
Right. You be careful. I'm going to stab you with my pen. So at this time, Tunnel was a big club as well, which is quite wild. That had really interesting things like that have 50 urinals and have a DJ booth either side, which is very cool. It was also described as the Auschwitz of Las Vegas. So.
gonna slap a problematic on that one.
Absolutely. But I think that's Michael Alec in a nutshell. His Club Kid or draggy looks were described as sort of anti-fashion, cartoony, and deliberately uncool, and a sort of dysfunctional glamour. So anyway, fast-forwarding a few years, because talking about clubs when you're not in them is boring.
Yeah.
And so he was employed by the Limelight, which is also a really big club at the time, which was in a church, which I thought was kind of interesting symbolism, having a gay club in a church. And he launched things like Disco 2000. And also, more interestingly, he launched a night called Blood Feast, which is a bit of an interesting foreshadow of things to come.
I love this. So this is in the film as well. And he's basing it around the movie Blood Feast.
Yes. And pretty much patrons would come in homage to their favorite serial killers. And yes. Some pretty weird things would happen, like Michael Ulick would piss in a cup and throw it on patrons.
I love it.
A woman would have sex with an amputee's stumps, which is interesting as well.
Which Bruce the Bruce did in a recent film.
There you go.
Not a recent film, in a film at that time.
And not to kink shame at all. That sounds like quite a show. I would definitely pay to see something like that.
Mm. Speaking of kinks, I think I heard that Michael likes to throw $100 bills on the grounds, like on the packed dance floor, and he'd get off on watching people like dive for the money.
He absolutely will. I guess this is why he had a bit of a reputation for being quite obnoxious.
Well, also aside that maybe there was some sociopathic/psychopathic tendencies at work.
Absolutely, yeah.
So at this point, so very vulnerable boy... there is a nicer version of the story, isn't there? That like he's found his people.
Yeah,
he's found his culture, but people around him seem to be picking up on these certain personality characteristics that are red flags. Right,
they're also very hard to ignore. I guess if you're getting really positive reinforcement. It also makes a difference if you're getting positive reinforcement by being invited onto shows like Joan Rivers and Geraldo Rivera. Yeah. You're pretty much getting your tires pumped up. You probably start to believe your own persona.
I think at this time as well that like people were liking things that were transgressive. The line between transgressive and like narcissistic and selfish and sociopathic is fucking thin sometimes.
Totally, and I see that in some people on the scene right now.
Yeah.
But obviously not everyone is killing people, which we'll talk about later. fingers crossed. No.
Good for future episodes.
So around this time also, he was accumulating like a higher tier of celebutants, which he would have seen it as people like RuPaul.
Mm.
Very interesting. Chloe Sevigny and Amanda Lepore. And there's a lot of photos that have surfaced, which I think is quite cool and quite telling of how big his impact was in New York City at the time. People like Björk were coming to the clubs and having fun. So that's, you know, I think if you're getting those kind of people coming to your clubs, you might start to believe that you're as important as
and
what you are.
As a promoter, he was getting a fair amount of money coming in, wasn't he?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I've heard different sources saying that Michael would act fucked up. Like, he would act like he was on drugs, etc. And then it segued into him actually becoming a bit of a drug addict. As his popularity grew, he became the monster within.
What age was he at this point? Early 20s?
He would have been about 21, 22 at this time.
I can imagine. Imagine earning like thousands and thousands of dollars a night in your early 20s.
Yeah.
I imagine he was... Because I don't know if this is accurate, but in the film, there was this view that when he first came into the scene, he was a bit anti-drug.
Yes, yeah. Yeah.
He was a bit innocent and a bit anti-drug. And then... once he started to earn the money, that's when he started getting on the party favors a fair bit.
Yeah, I think that comes part and parcel with nightlife as well. I guess it depends what your point of view is and how serious you are about the actual work. I'm sure Michael was very serious about the parties and throwing a great party and everyone having a good time. But I think where his headspace was becoming the monster and becoming the persona that he was trying to invent. And I've seen similar things in other stories, people like Lee Bowery, who is a performance artist from Sunshine, who moved to London, and maybe parallels were happening there, but Lee Bowery didn't kill anyone.
Mm.
Lee Bowery was more serious about fashion and art, and that's a different story, but I can definitely see what you're saying. And even from my personal experience, when you're getting people treating you like you're a star or bringing vodka backstage, etc., and having people stop wanting to pose for selfies, you can... You know, take it one way, this is really flattering, or you can just believe that you're elevated above everyone. I think that's what Michael did.
Particularly when he was getting positive reinforcement for doing things like throwing money onto the dance floor.
Or pissing on people.
Or pissing on people, or like throwing drinks on people. It was like the things that people liked about Michael Ulick, at least on my interpretation of it, was him being a bit of a dick. But, you know, on that line of it's all good fun.
Yeah.
It's that line. I mean, look. People in their early 20s, I can understand that.
Ah, absolutely as well. And I don't think that's just people in nightlife. I'm sure, like, most twinks kind of have that attitude as well. Hmm. For instance, a friend of mine was saying that he, just a few weeks ago before all this self-isolation thing was rightfully in place, he had this twink come up to him at the 86 saying, "I'm not scared of Corona. Corona can fuck me in the ass." And it was death dropping on the street. And now people on TikTok are, like, licking toilets. Again, this is people in their early 20s who just don't see how they come across or, you know.
What? They will in a few years. They'll want to...
They'll get a cringe.
Hit their head against that toilet, yeah.
Yeah, well, hopefully they do that now.
Hopefully, but probably not.
It's...
Yeah.
Just kidding.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
It is interesting this, 'cause, I mean... maybe a little bit earlier than this time, but around this time, you also have, like, John Waters, who's doing a similar thing. Like, there is a distinctively, like, gay aesthetic or impetus to do with, I don't know how to describe it. Like, transgression is one way of describing it, but yeah. Transgression to me makes it seem like they're self-aware, but often it's not self-aware.
Well, with Michael Alec pretending he was fucked up, I think there's an element of self-awareness there, so at least he understood.
The excess. This yes. appreciation of excess.
Yeah, even with things like Blood Feast, it's very apparent that he at least had a vision for these parties, and he had a vision for how he was perceived. Whether or not he understood, I don't think maybe he cared that some people found him obnoxious. As long as people were talking about him and talking about the parties, it was all about getting publicity, etc. So maybe the ends justified the means for him, and he probably didn't care what he would say was nobody's thinking about him being annoying.
Yeah.
Am I correct in thinking you've told me once about this theory of, like, a velvet rage theory?
Yes. Yes.
What is that all about?
So, boiled down, the Velvet Rage theory is that all gay men need validation, and they'll go to different lengths in order to get validation. With Michael Alec in particular, I think he got a lot of validation from fame.
Mm.
It's interesting that he came from this very humble means where he was bullied, etc., but he was also very intelligent, where his flamboyance may have been overridden by... may have overrode his intelligence or all his positives. So moving to New York and then getting validation for his parties and for his persona. I can see how that happened, particularly when fame is involved and you're getting reinforcement from people like RuPaul or Joan Rivers.
And I did look this up in terms of, because when you first said that to me, I remember being like, oh, I don't know, I don't necessarily feel like that. But
yeah.
There have been studies that seem to indicate mainly gay men, not lesbians, mainly gay men tend to fall into a perfectionist mindset.
Yes.
And I think that this is maybe a variant of that perfectionist mindset, which in some ways can be really, really constructive and really, really good.
Yeah.
But can also be, I mean, if the only validation that you're getting is being a horrible person, I feel like it can go into a really pathological sense. And
well, I think a stronger drug than MDMA or ketamine or heroin is applause.
Yeah.
So...
And do you know what? And I don't know if you see these parallels. It reminds me a bit about Luca Magnotta.
Right. Yeah.
A little bit. Mm-hmm. Like, as in that idea of that excessiveness...
It's funny that you say that, because I might talk about that in a bit when we talk about the eventual crime. The idea that Luca Magnotta was taunting the internet and taunting people, like, you know, trying to get publicity around this crime, etc. And Michael Alec did a similar thing.
Yeah. Michael is making a lot of money as a promoter. He's getting a lot of attention by being excessive and transgressive at this point. But... clearly, he was hitting the drugs quite hard.
Yes, and this is when drug dealers became a part of the payroll of venues like the Limelight. This is when we have Angel entering the narrative. We have Andre Angel Melendez, who was A-League's eventual victim.
Mm.
So Angel was described as a bit of a wannabe, a bit of a pest, and a bit of a desperado. He was not in the inner tier of like RuPaul and Chloe Sevigny or Big Erk or Amanda Lepore. He was a bit of an outsider and not cool in Michael Alec's eyes. So Michael would openly mock him and call him names like a pest and a wannabe, etc. Angel was owed thousands and thousands of dollars from Michael and his inner circle because he was supplying drugs to them and supplying drugs to the patrons at Limelight, etc. And
was he doing that to kind of make himself look cooler? Like, as in, was he getting himself in debt with these drug deals because he wanted to be more and more involved in the scene?
I don't know. Well, Angel popped up at all these parties and his shtick was wearing some wings, so I guess he wanted to be noticed. And from what I've heard, he was trying to penetrate that circle and trying to be one of the cool kids. And I guess
Sam just giggled at penetrate circle.
I'm actually giggling at the fact that he called himself Angel and wings were like his MO. Like, just how tacky that is.
And it's also a little bit of a foreshadow as well, seeming that he was an eventual victim. It's just like the symbolism there is just so melodramatic, isn't it? And this is when Michael was not very self-aware. No. So he was heard going around saying, don't you just wish that Angel was dead to everyone he owed a debt to. So that's not the smartest of thinking, if then you're going to actually kill the person. So should we get to the night of the crime?
I was going
to
say, I'd like to know about the murder. So was this, so we know at this point that Angel was Michael Alec's main supplier of drugs.
Yeah.
Or
at least a very prominent supplier of drugs.
And, you know, Michael didn't have a very good view of Angel, but Michael probably didn't have a very good view of most people.
I think Michael didn't have a very good view of anyone who wasn't Michael.
Yes. So what led to this actual eventual death?
So it was March 17, St. Patrick's Day, 1996. Michael's roommate was Robert D. Freeze Riggs. We'll call him Freeze. They were in their apartment, their luxury apartment, and Angel came around to collect the debt, or at least talk about the debt. And Michael did that thing, which a lot of people at crime scenes do, where they don't remember what happened. Mm. But in any event, there was a tussle between Freeze, Alec, and Angel, and Freeze was pushed into Michael's china cabinet, where a shard of glass broke, and we can't say what happened because no one remembers, but Michael or Freeze stabbed Angel with a shard of glass to death.
And we don't know, do we? We don't know which one actually did the fatal blow.
No, and also we'll talk about this later, but the body was found too late after the crime to determine that.
Do we know much about this Freeze?
Robert Freeze. Do we know much about Robert Freeze? He was in the club scene as well. Obviously, okay. He was good enough in Michael's books to be the honour of his roommate.
My impression of Robert Freeze is that he was a bit of a simple, you know, guy, not quite on the level of Michael Alec in terms of the duplicitousness and the planning.
So we don't know an awful lot about Robert Freeze and his motivations, etc. around the crime. I think the focus really is on Michael Alec, maybe because he is a celebutante, etc. or maybe because he just wants the attention. So he's really just a supporting player in this crime. So I imagine if I killed someone with another gay, we would be hopeless.
You imagine.
Yes, like imagine. It's never been done. So when I'm sure you would.
I know, I have a whole plan.
You'll be the first person I'll call.
I'm a lot of people's first person they'll call if they kill someone.
So anyway, these two gays are sort of flapping their wrists around with this dead body in Michael's apartment. So Freeze and Michael put Angel in the bathtub with some ice and some Drano. And they left him there for about 10 days. And in that time, they still socialized. They still had some people over. etc. And I like that they went down to Macy's and got a giant box and some Calvin Klein Eternity, which they sprayed around to get rid of the scent of decomposition, which I thought is the campest thing ever, especially because it's called Eternity.
Yeah.
And they're spraying around.
Eternity covers up your dead body.
And there's a dead angel in there. Yeah. It's just, you know, you couldn't write that, could you?
So how long is he in the bathtub? So at a certain point, Michael starts to cut up the body.
Yes. So he was in the bathtub for about 10 days.
And I imagine we're at the point, 10 days, depending on how warm the apartment is, there's a degree of decomposition going
on
there.
Yes, they did say that there was only decomposition on the bottom half of Angel. Like his top half was fine.
Because the blood...
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, they also got some knives and some bags, and Michael Orfries, that I've heard Michael did it, dismembered Angel, and they put his limbs into a garbage bag, and they put the rest of Angel in a giant box, which they put in their living room. And like I said, they still socialize at this time. So James St. James came around and put his feet on the box, and Michael said, "Oh, do these shoes look familiar?" And he was tapping his foot. He was wearing Angel's clothes, including his very famous footwear. Apparently, Angel had some very specific footwear that he would wear to the club, and Michael was blatantly wearing
them. Angel was a low-key icon then. They say he was nobody, but everyone knew what he was wearing.
Well, it was everyone's drug dealer.
Yeah, so I'm sure everyone knew him from that.
Yeah. I'm just trying to think of, like, what level the smell must have been at this time. Like, as in 10 days in the box.
I don't understand their thinking from moving it to the bathtub to a box. That doesn't really make sense.
Because there would be more fluid.
Yeah.
You would think it would link through the box.
Well, they probably weren't thinking.
Definitely not.
They were also on heavy drugs at this time as well. They eventually decided, well, we've got to get rid of this body. We can't have this just sitting in our apartment like a piece of glamorous decomposing furniture.
I mean, they could. So, but
if anyone has seen Paris is Burning, this is a very interesting side note. So Dorian Corey, who was a very prominent drag queen at the time, had a mummy in her apartment because she murdered an intruder.
I'm assuming a future Sinister Sissies episode on her.
I'll be tuning in. You believe you me, I'll be here for that because I think that's a really fascinating case. So, like I said, imagine gays trying to get rid of a body.
Yeah.
So they decided after some time, like, we should probably, you know, get rid of this, the thing that's in our apartment and causing a smell, taking up space, and people were getting a bit sus. So what they did was they caught a cab down to the Hudson River, and the cab driver actually helped them out and did that thing. You know what always happens when there's a dead body around? They're like, "Oh, what do you got in here, a dead body?"
Same thing happened with Jeffrey Dahmer.
Yes, and the suitcase. Yeah. The body in the suitcase. It's so bizarre. It's like, oh, little do you know. So again, gays trying to do something with manual labor, horrible. They forgot to puncture holes in the box before they threw it in the river. And Angel's body washed up on Staten Island soon after.
Because of the air causing it to float.
Yes, yeah. And apparently there was a big storm at the time as well, which helped push the box over to Staten Island. So they just had terrible luck.
Yeah.
Okay.
So...
well, they had good luck to knock
out. I don't feel sorry for them.
No, like, no.
Well, they had pretty good luck overall. They had a dead body in their lounge room for X amount of time and no one found it. So...
yeah. You know. It was, yeah, interesting. But there was an investigation, obviously, but Michael Alec had a big mouth, which will be a surprise to no one.
Yeah.
And he was just telling people that, yeah, they killed Angel. Oh, but don't tell anyone. And...
I'm trying to understand the motivations behind that. So do you think he wanted to shock people and this was good news?
So it was interesting that you brought up Luca Minotta earlier.
Yeah.
I think if they had got away with it, there would have been a level of disappointment. This adds to his persona in some way. Maybe it was worth the risk of people finding out about it in a way that's going to get him in trouble. I think he just couldn't resist the idea of this somehow being publicity. Also, a lot of people at the time thought it was just a big publicity joke and that Angel's just going to pop up at a club somewhere. Because he did things like Blood Feast and his brand was pretty risky anyway. It's, you know, not outrageous thinking to assume that that could be a possibility.
He was a copycat. He was one of those copycats that we hate, and so we killed him. I killed Angel, and... That's the kind of thing that gets me in trouble.
So the press started talking about this. There was an article in Page Six, which people may know as the scandalous section of the New York Post, and also a little bit of a debrief in the Village Voice, where the press was starting to talk about this. And at this time, it was an unidentified body floating up on Staten Island. So they didn't know who it was until November 1996.
Well, because, I mean, he was fairly well decomposed at this point, I was
sure. Yeah, by the time they found the body, and he wasn't identified until November 1996 as well. So in the inner circle, there were already a buzz around Angel's disappearance and his death because Michael was telling everyone. So, yeah, it wasn't until authorities found his body in November 96 when the heat was on Michael Alig and Freeze. So they were eventually arrested and they pleaded self-defense. They both offered a plea deal and sentenced to 20 years. And Michael Alig served 17 years and was released in 2014.
And what happened with Robert Freeze?
So he was released in 2010, so a few years before Alig.
And can we talk about the fact that you actually did try and reach out to Michael Alig?
I did. Well, he's out and he's on the social, so I slipped him a DM and he didn't reply.
Very rude, Michael.
Also, in context, it was for research for this show, not just because I was lonely in self-isolation.
Come on.
I like to keep it ambiguous.
Let's be real.
Absolutely. So Michael today is a wannabe YouTuber. It's quite interesting watching someone who has no idea about technology trying to be a social media influencer.
It used to be Gay Pride Week.
Right, and now it's been expanded to a month.
It's expanded to a month. And that's because you say why?
I said it was because the greedy party promoters want to have more parties, more pride parties.
Filled with greed and pride. Oh, those are two of the sins. Greed and pride, right?
Yes.
I mean, that is the legacy of Michael Alig. Do we know, after the film was made about him, did he have any response to that?
He gave it a B, he said. Okay. He said he saw it. So the film is Party Monster with Macaulay Culkin, which we discussed earlier. He gave it a B, so he didn't hate it.
Look, it's an okay film. It's a bit of a... It slows down midway.
I didn't like it,
no.
I will say.
Okay.
I haven't seen it since I was 15, but around the time it came out. But wasn't Chloe Sevigny in?
She was. It looked like they filmed her stuff like pretty last minute as well. There were some odd shots of her like eating a packet of chips, watching them on Geraldo. And one thing that Michael Alig has said, that everyone who got off drugs became successful. RuPaul stopped doing drugs, Chloe Sevigny stopped doing drugs, and then here they are. They're still going.
They rose above.
Unlike Michael Alig, who was arrested in 2017 for trespassing and smoking crystal meth in a park in the Bronx.
He's hitting his peak right now. He's great. He's great. He's great.
But I don't know what he's been doing really since then. I think he's still trying to kick around doing club stuff. But obviously it's a very hard sell because no one really wants to come to a club hosted by a killer. Is it?
He wants to reach out to Sinister Sam is looking at me with such fear right now.
Look, come on, Michael. When you're ready, come and get it. Sinister_Sissies. We'd love to hear from you.
Sneak into their DMs, Michael.
Yeah. Thank you, Josh, for telling us all about Michael Alig. I know we're midway through a pandemic, so is there something that you would like to shout out that you're part of in the near future?
If you would like to join the Pride of Our Footscray live streams, that would be wonderful, every Saturday. Yes, I guess all drag performers are now going digital, which is the best we can do at this time. We're happy to spread joy where we can.
Thank you all for listening to the Sinister Sissies podcast. You can follow us on Twitter at Sinister Sissies. You can also follow us on Instagram
at Sinister_Sissies. Get us to 100.
Sam is in charge of our Instagram, and we know from previous episodes that Sam does not believe in social media, so I'm forcing him to do this.
Well, look, it's an educational and enlightening experience for me. I'm already following about 50 guys I have the hots for, so it's going great.
Very nice. You can also follow me on Twitter at Jared Bartle. That is Jared with a Y. And until next time, stay sinister.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership.
Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.